Hello, and welcome to System Mastery, the podcast where we review a thing by talking about it and are generally wrong. My name is Jeff, and I'm with my buddy John, and this week we're taking a second look at the 90s OGL classic D20 Modern. More specifically, the Urban Arcana expansion for it. Is this game the greatest ever, or does it belong in a living dumpster? Let's talk about it on System Mastery. Welcome back. This is Jeff, and John, as always, is with me. How are you?
I'm great.
And lean in a little bit. There we go.
No.
This week, we are going to be talking about Urban Arcana. This is our first time talking about an expansion instead of a core game.
Last week, we did the actual core game for this, the D20 Modern.
Which is not very good.
Mostly it's just boring, really.
Yeah, it's boring, because it's very vanilla. It's very much an OGL kind of instruction manual for how to build a setting and not necessarily how to play anything. But this, I feel like we may have a slightly different opinion.
I don't know. Is your opinion this thing is balls out crazy and awesome?
Yes, it is. That's what...
Sweet.
This is one of the books that I personally own. We're reviewing... Actually, I own D20 Modern, too, because you need it to play this. But Urban Arcana is straight up amazing.
Yeah, this pretty much made up for you making me read D20 Modern, because that was some horseshit. But this is way better.
It really is. Okay, so let's get this out of the way. D20 Modern's Urban Arcana expansion is a role-playing game that lets you play in the modern world, except there's D20 races running around. So there's elves and halflings and dwarves.
Yeah, as much as the cover of D20 Modern, when you first saw that in a store, you might have gone, oh, it's modern-day D&D. That's neat. No, it's not. It's fucking boring as shit.
Yeah,
it's modern-day period.
It's just crappy Shadowrun, except not even set in the future.
No, it is just, what are you? We are modern-day and full stop.
Thugs versus cops, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Urban Arcana actually is D&D in present day.
Yeah, it's basically 1990s Chicago or New York, and there's a whole bunch of monsters running around, and no one believes you.
Yeah, it is very... You know, secret world, you know, someone sees a displacer beast and thinks it's a big dog.
Which, you know, it's funny to me because, you know, I think about Lovecraft books, Shadow over Innsmouth and so on, or the ones where there's fishmen and no one believes that there's fishmen because their brains just tell them, no, those are humans. Except that this is like halflings and illithids and stuff, and I feel like those are just too cartoonish and they aren't really trying to look like humans.
No, but the book at least tries to cover for that. So
oh, yeah.
It's got the shadow.
Yep.
And that is the veil between worlds. And so, you know, if you're an illithid and you come through the shadow into our world, there's a couple benefits. You get to learn whatever languages are spoken in the area you appear.
Mm-hmm.
So if you show up, you know, in a place that predominantly speaks French, then you also speak French. Hooray. And then in addition to that, you get sort of a glamour on you so that people think you look normal-ish.
You look like something that their mind would accept.
Yeah, so the illithid just looks like a dude.
Yeah, so you look like, but if you come through as a dragon, then you look like a small airplane most of the time, unless you're blowing something up, and then you look like a small airplane causing a gas leak to explode a gas station. Whatever. It's funny to me that we talked about this last time, that there's kind of a level at which humans will accept big lizards. Like, any bigger than an alligator, and that's gotta be a gas leak.
Yeah. So, you know, as soon as the dragon comes through, you're like, oh, that is, I'm seeing something weird. I can't deal with it. Too weird.
Yeah. And there are a couple of exceptions in the book, for things that can't quite get shadowed good enough, like beholders, because there's just nothing that a beholder could possibly be.
Yeah. It's just a big floating sack of eyes. And
yeah.
People are like, I don't think that is a bird of some kind. I'm pretty sure I've just gone insane.
What's up with that gross one-eyed face with a bunch of eyes for hair? Is that a, am I at a pride parade? Is that a float? So, where'd you think I was going with that?
You know how gay people
are just floating heads?
That's the new homophobic thing. Yeah, I'm pretty sure when you turn gay, you just become eyeballs.
Oh, the gay agenda is to shoot me with a disintegration beam. That's why I want to keep them out of my schools. Nothing against them. I just don't want my kids turned to stone.
Yeah, that's it. You know how the gays are all anti-magic with their big eye? Yeah, that's it.
No, no, I was saying that maybe he looks like a parade floater. I don't know. Maybe like if that Ace of Cake show was given the job to make a big floating face monster for their cake, and you're like, oh, I just can't currently see the two guys carrying that slowly.
It's just a balloon. It's a balloon. It's a That's balloon. All it is.
It's a balloon with a bunch of secondary balloons that are melting me. Okay, so there are a couple monsters that are immune, and there are a couple of monsters that blend right in. And then there's races that you can play as. So this has, the first book just had humans. You were playing as humans all the time. But this one gives you back all of your classic D20 races you love so well.
Yep.
Elves, gnomes, halflings, dwarves, half-orcs. But then it also gives you all those fun CR races that you'd remember from 3rd edition. I don't think it's CR. I think it's ECL.
Yeah.
And it's the level adjustment that this monster is too powerful. So if you're playing as him, you're playing two levels lower than your friends, which in 3rd edition D&D is a death sentence.
Oh, yeah. Because in 3rd ed, you're like, well, that means my spell progression is lower, so oh, fuck.
Yeah, because in 3rd edition, if you have any levels of fighter on your character sheet, that's a mistake. You have screwed up.
Yeah, then it doesn't even matter what race you're playing, yeah. You've already fucked up.
Sorry. Whoever wrote 3rd edition was absolutely convinced that strength was the only ability score that mattered. So if you were playing as like a half ogre or something and you get a +4 strength, they were like, oh shit, do you realize how hard you can swing your sword? We better give you a character level 4 levels lower than everybody else. Meanwhile, wizard.
Yeah.
So anyway, this book doesn't have that problem because as we talked about with D20 Modern, wizards are capped at like level 5 spells. Magic's really not as big of a deal.
Now, one of the other things I immediately had sort of a knee-jerk issue with going through is, so you have all the extra races and everything, and they have the standard D&D adjustments. So, you know, +2 constitution, -2 charisma,
mm-hmm.
dark vision, and so on and so forth. And the main D20 Modern book has nothing. Because there is no rate, you're just a human,
mm-hmm.
there was no adjustments, no anything, and so it just meant if you played a human and someone else was playing any other race, you're better than them because you get some bonus, whereas they don't. But it does come with the Shadowkin human option.
Mm-hmm.
So you can make a human that gets the, you get a bonus feat, you get +1 to all your saves. So the standard D&D human spread. So if you are playing in Urban Arcana and don't want to be a gnome or a bugbear or whatever, then you can just be a shadow human so you aren't completely fucked.
Right, because humans did not come with the standard bonus feat and the better multiclassing, because this game does away with the whole favored class multiclassing juggle.
Oh, yeah. Well, in That's the D20 gone. Modern book, they just assumed you were a human, so there was no need to adjust anything.
Right, they gave you the correct number of feats, so if you're playing as a dwarf, you were just better. This fixes it by giving that shadow human race into existence. Although, frankly, house rule, just let everyone play that. Because
oh yeah, you can just say
you don't need to be a human from another dimension to get a bonus feat. It's real easy.
Yeah, you just okay. You have these bonuses, great.
Yeah, so there you go. Okay, so in addition to the base races, there's also what like I think there's Azamar, Tiefling, Gnoll, half ogre, which
is a regular ogre,
which is ECL 3 or something crazy.
And, oh yeah, because he's strong,
because he's 12 feet tall and he's strong, and everyone thinks he's a giant stinky construction worker or janitor maybe. And bugbear's in there, yep. which I love. Kobold is in there, which I love. And drow. And let's get this out of the way. This book, whoever wrote this book and hired the artist to work on this book, had a real boner for drow.
And we don't just mean he had a boner for drow in that he included drow and everything, which he did, but also all of the drow are like, I'm showing my thong off.
Yeah, there's a lot of whale-tailed drow in this book. It's kind of surprising how much. There's, just like the last book, the D20 Modern, they did a lot of iconic characters. So there's Kurt the Dwarf, and there's Deacon Micklethwaite the Gnome.
Which, let me just go ahead and say, Deacon Micklethwaite is an awesome gnome name.
Also, every picture of Deacon Micklethwaite is amazing. He's amazing, he's my favorite thing in the book. But there's also Maddie Webb, the drow. I know, you can barely hear my partner's grunt. That's because Webb is stupid. And Maddie Webb is a, like, 90s raver girl with 3 R's. That's basically the concept you're supposed to get. She's wearing a belly shirt, and her thong is always showing, and she's always bending over.
She's got those sort of high-up pigtails.
Oh, yeah, the high-up pigtails. Like that goth chick on NCIS. She's got that hair.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she's always, like, on a motorcycle or dancing off the back of an unsuspecting guy's head.
Yeah, and, of course, every time you get a description of a drow in the book, it's always like, this drow NPC is sexy and alluring and
dangerous.
Every time she goes into a room, people lose the ability to speak because they're in awe of her. And I'm like, okay, we get it. You have a boner for drow.
On the other hand, there isn't a single picture in this book of an elf.
Yeah, no other elf gets a picture. It's all drow all the way down.
Yeah, there's a whole drow band in the book. Only Maddie gets a name, but the picture on the cover is of Maddie's super awesome alt-goth drow band with two other drow in it. One of them's got a, like, a hood, like a big hoodie, and he's like a badass looking dude with sunglasses. And then the other one's a girl who's like grungy. It's like the grunge drow. She's got like a pullover wool cap.
Yeah, the wool cap and the big
raver
coat.
Pants.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a whole drow band, which I assume makes garbage style music.
Yeah, probably.
Although Maddie is indeed the drummer, if you look at the other art. Okay, so you can make all those races. They actually have a really cool little picture in there of all the races holding up their character level. Like if you're playing as an Azamar, you're at +1 character level, so there's a nice little Azamar in there holding up the picture, and it's a little group shot, which I love because it's got it's got your gnoll and your tiefling and your half dragon and your snake blooded human, and then the gnoll is particularly interesting because for some reason he's just like a furry anthrocon lion.
Yeah, they didn't. Normally you see them and they're hyena men.
They're either hyena men or sometimes they're cat hyena kind of guys, but this is just literally, like, this is a lion whose name is probably like Blaze the Lion, and he's some guy's Sonic fanfic OC.
I was gonna say he looks like a Rift's uplifted lion man.
Oh yeah, that could be that too. But he really looks like furry art. Like, you know that specific look that defines furry art? Like, you can draw a werewolf and not have him look like his name is Tyler. But then you can draw a werewolf and have it known that that guy's name is probably Tyler because he's got that furry face. Yeah, that's what the gnoll in this book is.
So, you know, ignore that and just be an awesome, cool hyena man. I fucking love gnolls.
Yeah, gnolls are great. Also, the bugbear in this book, I don't know how they did that. Up until this book, bugbears were nothing.
Well, bugbears were just shitty orcs.
Yeah, they're just big furry orcs. They're like one level harder than orcs. That's all they are. That's all they've ever been.
Yeah.
Big furry shitty orcs.
They never had a personality that anyone gave a fuck about.
Yeah, they're just something that you find in a 10x10 foot room guarding a type J treasure. Now, this book, on the other hand, introduces Leonard.
Leonard is amazing.
Leonard is a bugbear wearing a tailored suit and a trench coat. He's got chains wrapped around his hands sometimes. Sometimes he's just picking his teeth. He's got a watch on a fob. He looks like he had his suit tailored to Bugbear.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's amazing. It's the best thing ever to give him that much personality and that much flavor on a Bugbear.
Yeah, and just the few images you get of him, you're like, I fully understand where Leonard is coming from.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
I'm up to speed on Leonard. Leonard is a bodyguard or something like that. Or perhaps he is an investigator who works the streets.
Perhaps.
He might have been fired by his chief for wrecking 20 cars.
He is, in fact, a loose cannon.
He is wearing leather boots, and it's not cow leather, and he wants to tell you what kind of leather it is. That's who Leonard is.
I'm pretty sure the only rules he plays by are his own rules.
That's good. Nobody else's. All right, so that's what those are. You still use the same class system as D20 Modern, so there's... Let's just to really quickly recap that, there are 6 base classes that are based on your 6 stats.
Yep.
So there's Fast Hero, Strong Hero, Tough Hero, Smart Hero, Dedicated Hero, and charismatic Hero. And then as soon as possible, you branch out of those because they're boring. You pick up some basic abilities, which you would recognize if you were playing 3.x D&D. Things like Evasion and Power Attack and so on can be found in those base classes. So you use them to build your core of what your character is. And then as soon as possible, you jump ship, because this is a very multi-classy game, and try to get into different classes. Now, all the classes from D20 Modern are still good. You can still go through and play as a soldier or a celebrity or whatever the hell you want. But this introduces a bunch of new ones.
And most of them are sort of loosely based on being D&D.
Yeah, so instead of a fighter, it's an archaic weapon master.
Yeah, and you've got things that are sort of... weird versions of a mage. You've got techno mage. You've got something like the mystic, which is a cleric that doesn't do healing, which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You get all of the divine spells, but you specifically cannot heal people. You're just sort of mystical.
Right, which I feel almost like they took that right out of Rifts. Because that's what the Rifts mystic is, too. It's a mage who casts spells intuitively, or maybe from a god, and you're not sure.
You're the
half-psychic half-mage.
You're half-psychic half-mage.
I know, yeah.
Come on.
I know. But it just feels that way to me. It's kind of like the, I don't understand where my magic is coming from character.
You're super new agey. You're like, I don't know, I've got these crystals and maybe they give me magic powers.
Yeah, I'm wearing a pyramid for a hat.
So, you've got a bunch of those. And those, again, only go up to 10 because this game...
Multi-classy.
You have to multi-class.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if you're like, I really want to be a mystic, that's what I am all about, at a certain point, it doesn't matter. You have to move on. And because of that, you get max level 5 spells, and one of the things, we mentioned that before, we mentioned the level 5 max spells, we mentioned that you only get to go up to level 10, but what they added in this to the spells is incantations,
mm-hmm.
which, if you played 4th edition, are a lot like the rituals in 4th ed.
Yeah, you'd recognize them right away. They take longer than an hour to cast. They duplicate an effect of a high-level or utility spell, which you otherwise would not waste your spell slots on.
Yeah, and it is open to anyone.
Anyone can learn them.
So it doesn't matter if you are, you know, I'm a strong hero, tough hero, and street soldier. If your arcane knowledge score is good enough, you can go, that's fine, whatever, I can still polymorph a motherfucker if I want to just by having this incantation. I don't need to be levels in a spellcaster class. And, like we said, all of the, basically like the level 6 to 9 spells that are utility spells or sort of good for the group spells are found in incantations. So teleporting, polymorphing, creating, anything. So like making golems and zombies.
And this right here almost completely fixes Dungeons and Dragons by itself.
Well, yeah,
the major problem with D&D is that there's all these spells that don't fit into the rule structure that basically get let one player rewrite the story however they want, and they're all at a certain level of wizard or cleric.
Yeah.
And that's it. So there's one guy at the table who gets to do them.
Most of them are just, what do you get to do? I rewrite reality to do what I want.
Yeah.
Okay, but it's only spellcasters.
Yeah, and there's no constraints, and there's no way for the DM to go, no, it doesn't work, without looking like an asshole.
Yeah.
Which is what Wish is all about. Wish is either let Jerry the caster do whatever he wants, or you're an asshole, DM.
Yeah. So it lets you get around that. And of course, there is no Wish.
Oh, not at all.
There's nothing like that. And even, like we were saying, the high-level incantations you can do, most of them are the more sort of decent utility, and you don't get into a lot of the level 9... like, I win spells.
Yeah, there's none of that. And also, they take a really long time, which makes them really good for villainous effects. If you go like, oh my gosh, they're about to turn the president into a toad. They're casting Baleful Polymorph in there. That sets your time limit for how long you have to get into the building.
Yeah, so now you've got 2 hours before they can turn the president into a toad. So you've got a good set amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
It lets you set up also, as a GM, some tension there of like, we're trying to do some spell to unturn the president from a toad back into a dude, and enemies are attacking. You've got to defend whoever's doing the incantation while he's doing it against these invaders. And they also added in a lot of the more powerful ones, so like Baleful Polymorph and any of the giant creation spells require X amount of people to help you. So it's like, this requires 11 helper casters to cast. So even if one guy's like, I'm amazing, fuck you, I can do incantations, he still needs, like, 11 dudes to cast it.
Which is great, because that's one of the problems with D&D, that the wizards are like, a D&D wizard is an iconic representation of a D&D wizard. Nothing else. There's no other wizard in any book ever.
No.
That is anything like a D&D wizard. Gandalf cast maybe one spell once, and probably when you weren't looking.
Yeah, and it's all just... what happens when Gandalf does a thing? Well, mostly he hits dudes with a sword, and then, I don't know, maybe he creates light.
Sometimes,
that's a level 1 spell.
Creates some light. One time, I think he set a pine cone on fire with his mouth.
Yeah.
He does little cool tricks, but at no point does he cast invisibility, and then fly, and then fireball.
Yeah, if he does anything cool, it's off-screen, because writers know that any wizard that can just win is fucking boring.
Right. And one of the things that you do find in books, on the other hand, is cult spells.
Oh, yeah. When you have, you know, 16 dudes in a room chanting around a pentagram and
with a naked lady chained up in it. Yeah, that's what that is. That's what you're getting out of this book, is the way that actual fictional wizards work. The fun way to read about them when they're like, oh, all of us are naked under these robes and we have a lady chained to a pentagram and soon it will summon Balgoth. And perfect. That's awesome.
Yeah, and it gives you as the player a couple options. now you don't even need to go after the caster. You can kill off his little helper dudes.
Mm-hmm.
You can try and disrupt whatever the focus of the ritual is. So it adds a lot of depth into that, what was in 3.x D&D, sort of a binary system of, I just do this and either it works or it doesn't, and it's amazing.
I think this is the closest we've ever skirted to just outright making fun of 3rd edition D&D.
3rd edition D&D is balls.
It is really balls. It was a mistake, and it should be treated as such.
So
there we go.
So this, I really enjoy that system. And then it's got a lot of setting stuff in addition to just character stuff.
Oh, tons of it. There's like all these organizations and interesting monsters and so on. And they do a really good job of playing with that whole shadow world thing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like that's if you're, say, for example, a gnome and you come to Earth, then you recognize that you are in another Earth because you can see the shadow. So you can see all these other gnomes and you can see all these dwarves and elves and what have you. And what does that lead you to do? It leads you to band up with them, because they are the only ones who aren't crazy.
Yeah. You know, it's really interesting to me the way that they incorporate the whole shadow thing into it as well. Take, for instance, there's a lot of organizations and things in the book. One of them is basically a workers' union for mm-hmm. the shadow kind. And one of the great things they say is, most of the time, when they go in and enforce things, it's against other shadow kind employers, because the human employers can't tell that their shadow kind employees aren't human, so they don't try to exploit them.
Yeah, but
shadow kind guys are like, I know that you are an elf, I know that you can do muh, I'm gonna make you do that.
Yeah, or that you're a kobold and you're not smart enough on your own to seek proper payment and representation.
Yeah, you're like, I gave him some beads and he was like, yeah, beads!
Exactly. And then he shows up with local 442 kobolds, and they're like, look, you need to give us better representation, or we'll wave the scorpion hanging from a stick at you.
So I absolutely love that they did put some thought into
how this would all work.
Yeah, how it interacts with other things. You've got a lot of organizations that you do have some evil ones. You've got, like, the Sons of Vengeance, or whatever the fuck it's called, that follow Hextor. And if you know your D&D gods, Hextor is the god of war, and he's kind of evil.
Yeah.
But it's all just biker gangs. That's great!
Yeah, I'm always amazed when I flip through that section, because there's so many organizations that they decide to put in. And a lot of them tend to follow a template. A lot of the bad ones are a race of D&D monsters that you may be familiar with. You know, Ifrit, Drow, Illithid, any of those kind of top-level mind control villains. And then all they do is they take over a multinational conglomerate and they run it.
Yeah. And I do like that they go, well, this is how you get power. You know, I'm a drow, I come in, I don't want to make a church, because the church doesn't get me a whole shit ton of power. Being the head of, like, News Corp gets me a shitload of power.
Also, LOL stopped answering my prayers when I switched dimensions.
Yeah.
So, you know, it makes perfect sense. The only problem I would have with it is that, you know, you look at the Corsoni family in the book, and the Corsoni family is a mob that is run by an Illithid. And he's like their godfather of Illithid, except that he's only one in the organization. Most of the organization is humans and some shadow kind. He has two big old Minotaur bodyguards.
Yeah.
And the problem that generates is, wait, is every Illithid this powerful? Is everything in the world that's awesome and bad run up by Illithid? Or is there pretty much very few of them here?
Well, I think obviously, the nice thing is, it leaves it up to the GM. They say, here are some organizations you can use. These are just ideas for stuff. You don't have to use all of them or any of them. But the great thing is you go, okay, let's say not a lot of Illithid have come through, and a few of the ones that did were more concerned about eating brains than establishing power.
That's true.
And so one guy decides, you know what, fuck you, I'm a mob boss now. And he gets his own mob boss, and it even says in there, being an Illithid, he could technically just run out all of the other competition in the town, but he doesn't want to draw that much attention. So he just sort of lets them exist and uses ridiculous mind control psionic stuff to keep tabs and fuck with them and turn other guys against each other. And he's mostly just doing it to fuck with people and have fun. And that's great.
That's perfect. It's just fine. There's an Ifrit that runs a multinational just business conglomerate. The Drow, I think, runs a news network.
Yeah.
And then there's also a restaurant that is run by shadow kind people.
And it is awesome. It's sort of
adorable.
The juxtaposition of having McDonald's and medieval times.
Yeah, so it's basically a medieval-themed McDonald's. Burger King, if they took it more seriously. That's what it is. It's called the Prancing Pony, which, great, nice little Tolkien reference, whatever. And then it's got... It talks about how the food there is normal, and it, but they do offer food that's specific to what people from another dimension might want, like mutton and so on.
Yeah, and then, they call it things like, you can get the rock wings, or you can get an elven garden salad, but it's all just, you know, some chicken wings and a normal salad, whatever.
It's all just playing with it. It's all, these are, whoever came up with this was like, I would love it if people from the Shadow were like, yeah, we're from the Shadow, let's fuck with everybody. Let's just take names we're familiar with and sell them to everybody else as kitsch.
And you get the Magic Meals, which are their version of Happy Meals that come with a toy. And the toy is magical.
It's a magic toy. It does magic toy things.
And so you can get, like, what did you get? I got a wind-up cat. And the cat can get wound up and move 5 feet, and maybe its eyes light up, and it lights up a 5-foot square. Is this at all anything powerful? No, it's a fucking little wind-up toy.
It's a little cantrip, yeah. Now, I feel like we may have given short shrift to the classes. Because I think we really want to talk a bit about how there's a couple different classes for everything and what you can do with the classes in this game.
Yeah.
So there's a bunch of them. Most of them tend to fall into lines that make sense in Dungeons & Dragons. Like, you've got Archaic Weapon Master. There is a more or less an Arcanist or Wizard-type class. But then there's also things like the Technomage, which is a class that focuses on interacting robots with spells and creating homunculi.
Yeah.
Which is kind of neat, because the homunculi in this aren't just fat little demons. You can make one that looks like a walking calculator, or one that looks like a mass of wires, because they really wanted to play up the tech.
Yeah. And this was sort of the precursor to the Artificer in 4th edition.
Absolutely. Although this book actually is the Artificer predates this book.
Well.
Man. Woo!
Knowledge!
Anyway, there's the Arcane Arranger, which I'm a huge fan of.
Mm-hmm.
The Arcane Arranger is a charisma-based class that focuses on getting necessary items. And it's supposed to be the kind of guy who's a sleazy wheeler dealer and knows how to get whatever crazy thing you might need, including magic equipment, and always has something in his pocket that's appropriate for an occasion.
Yeah, he's the guy who knows a guy.
Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff like that. There's a ranger equivalent in there. It's called the Pack Lord or the Wild Lord or something, and it's a person who runs around with a pack of animals and basically acts like a ranger.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there are a couple of ultra prestige classes in this, the equivalent of the level 21 classes from 4th edition. They are the Archmage and the Ecclesiarch. So there's one for the casters, basically. There's one for Arcane and one for Divine Casters.
Yeah, because they set it up so that you could only have 10 levels in any given thing. While for most of the martial classes, only getting 10 levels in something wasn't so much an issue, because you could just continue to be strong or tough or get some other martial class and it flowed together. Being a mage and only getting 10 classes of that and then stopping, you're like, well, I'm not really going to start being a, like, archaic weapon master after I was a mage. So it gives you a little bit of expansion beyond that so that you can keep growing in power.
Yeah.
And it's only 5 levels for these.
Yeah, and they add a couple of spells per day, basically, that sort of thing. They're basically a way to keep playing as a spellcaster and kind of play the big, bushy-bearded wizard of your dreams.
Yeah, so once you get to the max, which is the 5th level of it, it will double your spells per day.
Mm-hmm.
So before you'd cast, maybe, if you had a really good bonus to whatever your casting was, you'd get, like, 2 or 3 spells. So now you can actually cast a lot of spells per day. And let you be full-on just caster.
Which is fun. And also applies to a certain mindset of people that came up in 3rd edition Dungeons & Dragons. Because it didn't take very long. I was a player who played religiously in 3rd edition when it was out. And it didn't take very long for us to realize that you basically wanted to be the guy who called wizard first.
Yeah. You know, and if someone else called wizard first, you had better call cleric.
Yeah. Especially if it was like 2 or 3 years into the run of 3rd edition. Because when it first came out, they were terrified that people would actually take cleric and have fun with it. It was still coming in off the end of 2nd edition, and everyone was thinking that clerics are supposed to be just healers. Kind of cure light wounds on a stick.
Yeah.
And then people played with the cleric class in 3rd edition for like 10 minutes, and were like, oh, wait a minute, these are better than fighters.
Yeah.
At being fighters.
It was just, wait a minute, I can be in heavy armor with a big weapon, and then buff myself to be better than a fighter. Well!
So... Anyway, enough off the 3rd edition horse for a bit. Let's talk about the equipment in this book.
Okay, it is, we mentioned before, in the D20 Modern, they like to be hyper-specific. When they talk about cars, it's not just a sedan or a van. It is these specific cars, and they are, once again, super hyper-specific in this. If you are riding a bike, it's not just you are on a bike. No, you are on this specific mountain bike, or this specific racing bike.
You're on a Kawasaki Ninja. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And also regular bikes. Not even motorcycles.
Oh, yeah.
Regular bikes. They have a regular bike in this book for a policeman.
Yeah. And what is it? It's a mountain bike that has some pouches on it. That's it. That's all you get. But we decided it needed another entry.
Wouldn't you say that's more of a bike for, like, a Rob Liefeld character?
Yes. It is a super 90s bike.
It's got pouches all over it. No feet, which, you know, doesn't really make a difference from the other bike.
The bottom of the wheels.
It's always in a cloud on the bottom. It's got a magic ability to always be under a cloud.
Just super bulked up handlebars and really tiny wheels.
Oh, yeah, and the handlebars point in directions that aren't quite straight for where they should be.
Yeah. Okay. It is the Liefeld bike.
That's the Liefeld bike. Three ponytails. Its name is Blood Bike. Shot. Death.
Hammer.
Grim.
Wild.
Cat. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So, it adds that, and again, it's just sort of adding on more to what you got in D20 Modern. It's just a lot more examples of things.
Yeah.
But it does add on magic equipment.
Of course, because there's magic now, so they need to have magic equipment, and the magic equipment in this book is a mix of the standard magic equipment you'd expect from 3rd edition D&D.
Yeah.
Plus
you get
one
your,
swords.
You know, yeah. Staff of Power, your Amulet of Pure Evil, and all of that stuff you would assume to find in, like, a DMG or any of the treasure guides. You're like, yeah, okay, I get that. I know what that item is.
It's boring, and you can ignore it. Yeah. Now, on the other hand, this book went crazy with what would happen if you let modern people develop D&D magic type items. So you have the Rod of Technology and the Enchanted Biker Jacket.
And the Bumper of Ramming.
The Bumper of Ramming and the Horn of Blasting, which is a car horn.
Yeah. So it added, there is an entire section in the book of magic items that just go on cars.
Oh, yeah, there's a ton of them. Also, there's a motorcycle that's like an alive demon Ghost Rider motorcycle, which I love. But yeah, there's all these really great magic items, like cell phones and watches, anything, wallets, anything that's a modern item, they have a magic version of it that does a crazy magical effect.
Yeah, so instead of a, like, bag of holding, you can get a purse or a wallet of holding, so you can get stuff in there that would be more along the lines of something you'd see in modern day.
Absolutely. It's really, really fun to play through these and to try and come up with them. It's a great little bit of creative inspiration.
And, you know, you've got, like I said, basically like the bag of holding that turns into a purse or a wallet. You have some of those items that are playing on what was an earlier item and then just turning it into sort of a modern day thing. And then you've just got actually fully new modern day items that only exist in this.
Right. Yeah, there's a couple of like lasers and ionic weapons and so on. But here, just for fun, let's talk a little bit about some of these magic items that exist in this game. This is, I'd say, reason number two or so of why I actually really like this, which is rare for me with an OGL thing.
Huh.
Okay, the Chainsaw of the Psycho.
There you go.
The Cloud Kill Grenade. The Blade Gun.
Which, oh, the blade gun.
Just turns from a gun to a sword. Yeah, there's a ton of these. I'm stuck on weapon modes right now, but there's a bunch more really fun ones in here.
And,
you know, potion of vehicle handling.
Yeah, in addition to, like, potions and weapons and stuff, there are tattoos that you can get that do
things. Sure, the tattoo of Broken Arrow, or the bullseye tattoo. Those are fun.
Yeah.
The decoder ring. I like that. That's a ring that lets you read different languages.
And actually, in the Prancing Pony Magic Meal, that comes with temporary tattoos that give you the tattoo magic item thing and are just sort of wash-off magic items. And that's awesome.
The instant icebox. The Eldritch cell phone. The cell phone has an unusually long and odd-shaped antenna, but is otherwise nondescript. Although, let's face it, in a real modern environment, any antenna on your cell phone would be very nondescript. Or descript.
It would be
very
descript. Super descriptive.
People would be like, what the fuck is going on with that? Okay, let's see, what does it do? Oh, look at that. If a person being contacted doesn't have a phone, the Eldritch cell phone automatically dials the phone nearest the individual.
Oh, well, there you go.
That's actually pretty rad.
Yeah.
So there you go. There's a lot of really fun stuff you can get for magic equipment in this game.
Yeah, and of course, like in everything in D&D, all of the wondrous items like the magical cell phone are way better than your standard, like, what is this? It is a gun plus two.
Which, of course, exists in here, along with all of the burst and shocking descriptors and so on from Dungeons & Dragons, so you can have a plus two shotgun of shocking burst.
Yeah, so, you know, if you really want to get a flaming chainsaw, you can have that. That's fine.
I don't know why you're saying that with such a tone. That sounds awesome.
Well, I prefer to just set my chainsaw on fire the old-fashioned way.
Pour gas over it. Why is your chainsaw on fire? It's electric.
Well,
I would personally prefer to get magic items that are just enchanted versions of American Gladiator equipment. As long as I'm playing the 90s.
Big foam things on a stick.
Huge foam thing that when you hit people, it explodes in an icy cloud.
You get one of those things that shoots tennis balls that has a little guard for your face. And you're like, yeah, fuck you.
Each one of these explodes in a cloud kill grenade. Man, Turbo's taking it way more seriously than usual.
Turbo in this was played by a bugbear.
Oh man, why aren't we writing that campaign right now?
Okay, that's happening.
Urban Arcana Gladiators.
Podcast over, we're playing Urban Arcana Gladiators.
Where a bunch of muscled up bugbears shoot at you with cloud kill cannons. Also, they're all wearing spandex leotards.
Oh, well, of course they are.
Well, duh. Okay, alright, so, in addition to a really, really good magic item section, this book's also got a really, really good and really thematic magic monsters section.
Oh, yeah. The monsters are a good mix of classic and updated, just like the magic items were.
Sure. You want an orc? There's an orc.
Yeah. You want a, you know, beholder? There's the beholder, like we talked about. Although, he tends to hang out in the sewer and mostly try to psychically get followers. There's actually a beholder faction in there.
Absolutely.
And he gets homeless people to do his bidding for him.
Sure, that makes sense. I'm pretty sure that's how they work in D&D, except they do it to kobolds, who are in here.
Yeah.
Kobolds in here are great. There's a picture of the kobold Meepo, who is dressed up as a soldier and leaning against a fire hydrant and is adorable.
Yeah, and so you've got, you know, displacer beasts and things like that. You've got your standard D&D monsters, and they're just... also, in the D20 Modern book, like I mentioned last time, they pretty much just copy-pasted the monster manual, and maybe if you were lucky, gave you an extra paragraph saying,
"Oh yeah."
Also, maybe they exist in modern day.
And if they do, they like cell phones. That's the kind of thing they did.
But in this, it's just a straight-up new writing on all of them.
It's integrated. Everything is integrated. Orcs even are integrated. It talks about how they have a specific disdain for other shadow creatures. They end up working with humans. They end up taking construction jobs and hanging out in bars. They give a lot of flavor to the way an orc operates in a modern society.
Yeah, rather than just saying, we're going to copy-paste over this and then maybe talk about one thing, it's fully newly written, everything is fully integrated into the world, and then you've got goofy, weird, new stuff.
Which is perfect, because it's all stuff that plays on kind of horror movies of the past 20 years or so. So there's, like, roaches that infest a person and then burst out of the person as a giant roach.
Yeah, and you've got... things that are like, what is this? It's a sludge monster. So...
Oh, yeah, an animate pile of radioactive waste. Anything like that that kind of plays on our fears of, you know, modern society's downfall.
Yeah.
The living dumpster is actually in this book, and it plays on the whole concept of you never know what's down an alley, and isn't it spooky when you're all alone in a dark place, that kind of thing. There's a man made out of leeches. There's a golem made out of gears.
So it really wants to take things that you are... familiar with, update them to this, and then take kind of those modern myth things where people are talking about, like, yeah, there's the Mothman, and he exists, and so, you know, we'll turn him into a D&D monster.
Oh, yeah, there's Skunk Ape. I mean, I'm looking at Skunk Ape right now.
Yeah.
And Skunk Ape is basically Sasquatch, Harry and the Hendersons type character.
Yeah, so it wants to... because, you know, all of the D&D monsters were generally, like... what is this? Mythological creatures from the olden times.
Usually, yeah, Norse or Scandinavian myth.
And so now it's, you get those plus modern myth.
Yeah, modern mythical effects. Like the toxiderms are a really good example. The toxiderm is basically a mix between a slime and a golem, and it's made out of industrial runoff. So it's basically when mankind lets its disdain for the environment run amok, you get these giant super monsters that only Captain Planet and the Planeteers could possibly defeat. Or maybe the characters from Ferngully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there is, and again, there's a faction in here run by an elf that's all, like, super eco-terrorist, hates, like, urban sprawl, and is all about fighting shit like that. You can set a campaign where you play in that faction, and you'll fight things like the Toxoderm and whatnot.
You should set it as a high-level campaign, because the lowest level Toxoderm is CR-15. They are all extraordinarily dangerous.
Well, of course they are. They're fucking runoff.
Yeah, only Captain Planet can beat them. I mean, come on, he doesn't need a CR2 monster.
Yeah, that's for the Planeteers to fight.
Yeah. Yeah. Fight that with heart. Okay, and then they can actually give you things like radiation sickness. And then there's a number of demons and a number of angels that are fighting those kind of wars. So if you wanted to play a game that's kind of like Hellblazer,
yeah,
then you get that done.
There's a lot of those, like, we're trying to hide in society and there's a secret war. So if you want the Hellblazer or the Underworld or any of those things, if you want to set your campaign in the world, the rich, wonderful world of I, Frankenstein, then by God, we will let you do that.
Oh, I, Frank. You know my favorite thing about I, Frankenstein is, and I'll tell you, it's that in Spanish, it's called Yo, Frankenstein. Which to me sounds
That is an Urban Arcana game.
I know.
Yo, Frankenstein.
Yo, Frankenstein. I like to think of it as either an Urban Frankenstein from the Yo, Frankenstein, or that's a 90s Nickelodeon kids show.
Frankenstein, you're bold.
Yo, Frankenstein! And then like... Tonight on Yo, Frankenstein, he has to learn a valuable lesson about sharing.
Oh, yeah. Come on, Bolthead, let's go!
Oh, I don't know if I want to, werewolfie.
Yes.
That was a fun digression. I feel like I, Frankenstein is itself set in the rich, wonderful world of Underworld. It's just not saying that it is.
Yeah.
It's the same crap. It's just sexy versions of monsters fighting each other in weird CGI fast shots so you can't tell what's going on.
And if you want to set your Urban Arcana game in that, it really will allow you to do that.
Do it! I mean, I think one of the classes in here is Kate Beckinsale.
Yeah, if you want to go ahead and say, you know what, I'm a half vampire monster hunter, then, you know, you can do it.
Sure, go for it. Oh, okay. So this does a really good job of letting you set your story in the world of kind of urban 90s, like, sci-fi fantasy-ish movies, of which there were more than a few. I mean, you could play Mortal Kombat with this game.
Yeah.
You could play Spawn with this game.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things I think that happens is you also get a magic system, to go back to that, that also plays into it. So not only do you have the magic items that are like the magic cell phone, but you have things like one of the level 5, the high level spells you can get is a teleportation spell that teleports you by IMing yourself to someone.
Oh, yeah, you can send someone an instant message and pop over there. And there's a lot of that. There's a level 0 spell I particularly enjoy called Haywire, and all it does is just make machines go wrong. Like,
yeah.
You can point at a machine and just go, hey, flash a bunch of things. Flash no sale a bunch of times and open your cash drawer cash register. Or I can fuck with that escalator, which I'm amazed. You can fuck you with an escalator as a level 0 effect. That's a big thing.
Yeah, actually, the level 0 spells in this, normally, you've still got your standbys of, like, mage hand
light.
And light.
Yeah.
But you get things like Haywire, you get things like Daze, where
Daze
you can
is
just
OP.
Stop a guy from doing anything for a round.
House rule suggestion number 2, get rid of Daze right away. It's a level 0 cantrip that is a round shutdown. Which means if you're fighting a giant, powerful monster, and it's just one of it, you can just go, oh, your job as the wizard is to just cast Daze 9 times? Well, we beat it to death.
And one of the interesting things, you can get a feat that is added in this, where you have a magical heritage. So either you come from a race that's very magical, or your parents knew magic, or whatever.
It's great for when you're a gnome, because gnomes are supposed to have 3 little level 0 spells they can cast.
And so it gives you 3 level 0 spells per day.
Yeah.
And because the level 0s are actually useful for something, you can do things with it, and it doesn't just become a flavor feat. It lets you actually use a feat for doing something interesting.
Yeah.
Feats do, just like in the D20 Modern, probably the weakest part of this.
Yeah, this is the logical outgrowth of what a third edition forced on people. They put so many feats in the game, and then they constantly tried to use feats to fix the math. It was like, yeah. it's sometimes hard to hit people, and sometimes there aren't enough skills. And the answer was always, feats, put in more feats. It's options, isn't it? And it really isn't options, because you end up needing all the ones that are core. You need weapon finesse, you need power attack, you need the one that lets your basic attack be set to whatever your highest stat is.
Well, there are just some that are like, well, these are obviously what you have to take, and certain things for giving bonuses to skills, if you're all about, say, incantations, you're going to take a skill focus on arcane lore, things like that, where it just becomes a small fiddly bonus, and it's nothing that changes how you play.
And there's even more of those, this is feat, is two bonus, or plus two bonuses to two skills.
Yeah, because they added in a bunch of skills that have to do with magic and shadowkind and all of that goofy archaic stuff that, like, wielding exotic weaponry and having a gnome hook hammer. So there's all of those in there. So they had to add feats in there that cover all of that as well. And again, it's just, what is this? Just stuff that doesn't matter at all.
Yeah, and it's because they realized early in the third edition development cycle that feats were a way to give people fun choice. Because if you look at a second edition character, you're like, I'm a level 5 fighter. What's a level 5 fighter have? I know that off the top of my head, and I haven't played second edition D&D in 12 years. And the reason I know off the top of my head is because there's only like three things a level 5 fighter has. A level 5 wizard has third level spells.
Yeah.
And there you go. That's what a level 5 wizard has. So they wanted to try and branch that out, so they did it with these feats, and then they made a lot of them boring, but at the same time, they made some of them amazing. So,
well, they made some of them mandatory, yeah, is the problem, because it's a math fix.
So it looks like choice, but it's not, and that's just kind of a shame. I mean, don't get me wrong, the feat problem exists in every edition of D&D that has feats. It's a problem in 4th edition, too.
Honestly, it crops up in almost everything that even uses feats. Yeah. There are a few games out there that will use them where you get way fewer than you would in, say, a D&D game, but they actually change the way you play or inform your play in some manner.
Yeah.
Whereas these are really just, get like a plus one to something.
The other problem with them is generally that you will have them all chosen at level one. Like, you'll know exactly when you're getting them and exactly what they'll be. And that's a big problem in 4th edition. 4th edition looks like you're making a million choices, but realistically, you've made them all already. Like, I'm level 7. That means this is the level where I can finally take a cold weapon attack or whatever. So you know what you're doing all the way up. And the choice is more of a follow a track.
Yeah. And I will say this, for as many of those plus two to some skills things that they have, it actually becomes something you might want to get, whereas normally skills are just sort of awful. Here, because it's set in the modern day, you use them a lot more,
yeah.
And most of the, like, sort of prestige class things have a, like, knowledge theology of 6 ranks or whatever, so if you want to get into it sooner, you can spend your early feats on going, all right, I'm going to get plus two to my knowledge theology. I'm going to get plus two to whatever else they have.
I hate to do it, but that is not correct, because those are skill ranks as opposed to skill bonus level. The feats give you they give you a plus two to the roll, but they don't actually give you ranks.
I want plus ranks. Where's my feat for plus ranks?
They don't do that, because that way people will get into the prestige classes too early.
And then
that was a D&D problem, and they shouldn't have carried it over to this. Quite frankly, I feel like if this game didn't have levels in Fast Hero and bullshit, that'd be fine.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably start your game off as an Arcane Arranger, and no one's gonna give a fuck.
Right, I get the impression a lot of people played D20 Modern and Urban Arcana at, like, oh, you start at level 5. You don't have to spend a bunch of time fighting kobolds working at the local Prancing Pony. And you don't have to spend a bunch of time going, well, I'm a strong hero too.
Yeah, I'm just waiting until I become the thing I want to be.
Yeah, so that wouldn't surprise me. The other, I'd say, weak link about this book would be it's got a really comprehensive set of vehicle combat rules,
which, for the most part, don't matter much.
Unless you're playing, like, TMNT Roadhogs or Car Wars.
You know, or if you're fighting against that aforementioned biker gangs and you're a, like, rival good bike gang.
The problem with vehicle combat in most games has been that it's binary resolution. It's like, roll to control the vehicle. Did you succeed? Great. You keep fighting over, you keep shooting at the other guy. Did you fail? You crash. Fight's over.
Yeah.
So,
they did at least add some nuance. It's still binary because it's D&D and every skill is binary.
Yeah.
But you had things like, you can roll for stealth and spot checks and things like that in specifically vehicles.
Yeah, which is all right. I'm almost never a fan of comprehensive vehicle combat rule sets in games because they just don't seem to come up as much as the writer of the game figures they would have. Like, normally you resolve your car chase by just saying they either get away or they don't, because it's narrative stuff.
And usually it's just, well, you're shooting out the window at them, and if you want, you can go, well, if you're, like, trying to maintain control of a car while shoot, you just get a minus two to your shot or whatever. It's an environmental penalty. There right. you go.
And if you're playing as a character who drives, like, this was one of the biggest problems with Shadowrun, for example, is they had that rigger class. It was like, what are you? Oh, I'm really good at driving. Oh, okay, well, we have to go inside that building. I don't want to.
Yeah. And you had that same problem in anything like Rifts, where you're like, what is your OCC? I'm a pilot. Well, we're not piloting anything. Well, I'll stand over here then, guys.
Yeah, let me just take my glitter boy in the building.
So it gives you a bunch of rules that are, I mean, they're not terrible, but they rely on skills which are terrible. So.
Yeah, and they're extraneous. But on the other hand, they don't detract from the fact that this is actually a really good game. Like, I mean, if I'm saying a weak link is that it's got a bunch of rules you don't need, that's cool, because you can ignore that whole section and still have a really fun game that somehow managed to crawl out of the ass of the D20 system. I don't know how that happened.
Yeah.
All right, so we're about 50. You want to go ahead and wrap this sucker up? Let's go ahead and do favorite and least favorites. So, John, what is your favorite thing about D20 Modern Urban Arcana
City of Violence? Let's see. I'd probably go with... I actually want to say the organization section. I love the flavor that it adds.
There is a ton.
Because when someone tells you, like, it's D&D in a modern day, there's a lot of different ways they can go with it. And instead of just saying, here's all of these items and monsters, you decide, they give you a lot of different ways to go about it. You can have, like, an evil cult that worships Weejass, that's basically the Skull and Bones society.
With worms coming out of it, yeah.
And you've got, like, necromancers and whatnot, but then you've also got, like, charity organizations based around St. Cuthbert, you've got biker gangs, you've got news conglomerates, you've got all of these different ways to try and modernize what is D&D, and you can use some, none, all of it, whatever you want to do, but it really lets you have a good flavor to what you're doing and informs what the writers were thinking the world was going to look like.
Sure. And your least favorite thing?
Least favorite is the overabundance of drow and how completely bonerific they are about the drow. They show up in everything. Every example of something has a fucking drow in it. I don't care. I don't like drow. Also, every time I see anything and it's like, yeah, this is urban elves, I go, are they just urban elves because they're black?
That's kind of a fear you get, but the art doesn't really back that up, because they're dressed like garbage dressed in the 90s. Like, they're all wearing, like, low hip-hugger pants, and the one dude drow is dressed like, I don't even know what that outfit is. It looks like something that Brad Pitt would have worn in the 90s. He's got, like, his collar popped and outside of a leather jacket. He really looks like John Travolta, the drow.
Lol.
So, okay. Anyway.
So, your favorite, least favorite?
I would say my favorite thing about D20 Modern is that it's got a D20 magic system, and yet I still don't want to tear my hair out when I look at it. It actually has a functional magic system.
Which is amazing.
Somehow. It's not necessary that everyone play as a wizard, and if someone does play as a wizard, they aren't dominating the game. It's impossible. It's a Vancian casting magic system with D&D spells that isn't terrible. I don't know how they did it, and yet here I am holding a copy of the book where that has happened. So I'm a big fan of that. I also enjoy the rituals, and I like that they have functional level 0 spells, and I like that there's a lot more access to the magical controls of the game for everybody. If you're playing as a gnome who took a couple levels of Smart Hero and then went into Arcane Arranger, you can still get some spells and do some spell effects in the world, and it's fine.
Yeah.
I also, as a corollary, really enjoy the art in this book. Just want to put that out there. Oh, I forgot to say that was my other my actual favorite, but there you go. Least favorites. You know, it's almost definitely going to be the same least favorite as I had for D20 Modern, which is the bloated, unnecessary feat system.
Yep.
There's just too many feats that don't matter. When you read through that section of the book, you're just like, teacher, what do you get? +2 to academics and +2 to social. I don't care. There's so many of those. And they don't really help. It's just a bunch of dross.
Well, yeah, it's mostly boring.
Right. So there you go. And they could fix that by cutting the number of feats down dramatically and actually having feats in the game that do stuff.
Yeah. And they do. There's a couple in there that do. We've talked earlier about that one, that magical heritage one that lets you have a couple of level zero spells. That's an example of a feat that's a good idea.
Yeah, it lets you actually change what you're doing or add some cross ability from something. So if you had a feat that lets you, I don't know, be better at doing something with a sword or a gun or whatever when you were a mage, maybe casting spells through something, that would be interesting.
I always thought a great example of a D&D feat that's fun and flavorful is familiar. If you have a familiar, like, what's this? It's a little animal and it hangs around me and it gives me a couple of bonuses and I can control it to go do stuff and so on. That dramatically changes the way that your character is perceived, because he's always got like a rat on his shoulder or something, and it gives him some utility, and it gives him some powers, and it gives him some bonuses. If your character had three feats and one of them was familiar, you would notice familiar very dramatically, and I like that as a concept.
Yeah.
Okay, so there you go. Now, final question of the day. Would you play D20 Modern, Urban Arcana, Sky City Realms of Jorun?
Oh! You got me! You got me!
All right, go ahead.
You know, I would, and that's the weirdest thing, is when we're joking around on all of these different goofy-ass campaign settings of running, like, Urban Arcana Gladiators.
Urban Arcana Gladiators is happening.
I would run that in a second. If someone walked into the room, handed me a sheet, and was like, you're gonna be Diamond, I'd be like, I'm fucking on board. Let's do this right now.
I am Diamond. What am I, a Gorgon? That's so good.
Yeah, I'd be like, no, I don't care. It's happening right now.
That's the best idea. You heard it here. No one else can take that idea. Urban Arcana Gladiators is ours. That's our campaign.
I licked it. It's mine.
I would also play this, and I have always wanted to. I've owned these books since they were new. Like, I bought these, and this is a first printing copy I'm holding on to. You can tell because there's a couple of glaring errors in it.
Oh, yeah, where they fuck up what the Null's character level is.
It took us forever to figure out what the fuck that is, because if you look at the picture of all the races together in a group, there's this lion, and you're just like, what the fuck is the lion? Why is there a furry there? Also, he is wearing, like, a bandana tied. He looks like he's like a furry who went to Sturgis.
And he's holding up a +1, but in the description for Null, it says his level is +2, so you're like, well, he's not a Null.
He's not a Null, and there's no lion man who is into water sports, according to his hanky. So what am I looking at? What is this thing? And no, it's just that they fucked up and gave his description the wrong level adjustment.
Yeah.
So, anyway. I've owned these books forever. I would love to play them. I've always thought there was a lot of potential in there. And so, yes, I would also play this. So there you go. Just to prove that we aren't relentless douchebags who hate every game we review, this is a game, a third edition D&D-based game that neither of us hates.
It is a Christmas miracle is what it is.
Yeah, I want to shout about D20 Modern to the kids outside my window.
It's not too late! I haven't missed it!
Buy me the fattest D20 at the Gosha's. I must get character sheets to Cratchit's.
God cast bless on us, everyone.
Lovely. Okay, so let's wrap this up. This has been System Mastery. Tune in a couple of weeks. We'll review something else. We're looking for suggestions, so if you feel like telling us what to review, go ahead and drop us a line.
Leave it in the comments below.
You can do so either in the comments below on our actual website, which I don't think has ever happened. You can contact us on Facebook.
Woo!
I remembered first time this time. So System Mastery's page at Facebook, just called System Mastery. We also have a Twitter of System Mastery. You can find us at systemmastery@gmail.com. The actual website is systemmasterypodcast.com.
And System Mastery, as a word, has now completely lost all meaning to me. System Mastery to me, System Mastery, System Mastery.
It never meant anything in the first place, as far as I'm aware. I think it meant that we were douchebags who thought that we're better at playing games than other people.
I'm pretty sure that's still true.
Also true, yes. So, thanks very much, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.